Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, where you will hear us comfortably and reasonably say our names together in a harmonic fashion.
According to whom?
Whom?
Whom? Harmonic, I wouldn't quite go that.
Well, we weren't disharmonic. We said it together in approximately in a harmonic.
We weren't dissonant. I don't know. I think to some people it might be a little bit akin to nails on a chalkboard to hear us talking. Just
well, you know, they can always change to a different nails. Well, wait a minute. 10-inch nails, isn't it? Wasn't that a famous...
Nine.
Nine-inch nails?
Nine-inch nails, yeah.
And they made a lot of money by being nails.
I think you just came up with a better band name. 10-inch nails.
Right. That'd be bigger and better, right? Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach and the Personal Wealth Coach telephone number, which happens to also, for the next 2 hours, or almost 2 hours, be the same telephone number as KTEM, is locally and everywhere else. Area code is 254 if you're everywhere else or anywhere else, but locally it's 773-1400. I also need to inform you, stand by to be informed. This is a disclosure that the Personal Wealth Coach is not merely, just, or only a radio presentation. You like that?
Mm-hmm.
It's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, but not approved or disapproved. And the secretary will disavow any knowledge,
right,
probably under
should,
most.
Should we decide to accept the mission?
Yeah,
to,
should we? Yeah. And at that point, if you have a reel-to-reel tape recorder running that you're hearing it, this on, it's
destroyed.
Going. Yeah, the tape will start to smoke. And what was funny? Did you ever see those opening scenes where happened?
Yeah.
They'd be like on an airplane,
right? And the thing would catch on fire,
and the tape
itself
would catch on fire, and nobody would say anything,
right?
Which.
Well, that's okay. There was a lot of smoke in those airplanes anyway. People were smoking.
Oh, that's right. You could smoke. And the further forward in the aircraft you were, the forward part of the aircraft was where the smoking section was.
Right.
So
that's because it saved money on cigarettes for the pilots. See, they didn't actually have to buy cigarettes because all the secondhand smoke was plenty.
Well, that was cool. I mean, you know, preserve them. That way they didn't rot or anything and all that smoking. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and according to our records and our instruments in here, very detailed instruments, today is Saturday, March 26th. So if it is Saturday, March 26th, which is the day before Easter, if you are part of the Western Church.
Right.
Now, if you're Eastern Orthodox, it's at a different time. So don't get upset at us and wage a crusade or something.
Right.
No, the crusades went the other way.
Yeah, that's it was right. A different direction.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So,
And just as a side note, so that our listeners can get just as technically savvy as we are,
right,
the very well-formed instrument that we used to tell what the date was called a calendar.
I didn't use a calendar.
You didn't use a calendar?
No, I used a computer.
Well, the computer has a calendar in it that you were using.
I've looked all through that computer, and I've never seen the calendar.
I can show it to you. You just click on the date.
No, I'm not talking about that thing.
See, that's a calendar.
Oh, well, I'm talking about somewhere deep in the workings of the little chip in there.
Oh, the paper calendar.
Yeah, I know what a paper calendar looks like.
Yeah, it's in there somewhere. Otherwise, the computer wouldn't know.
Now, how does it know when you turn it on, though, after it's been off? How does it know what day it is?
Oh, it has to look at the stars and...
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that might be the level of the Nile River or something like that. Anyway.
There is a little battery on the motherboard that does that.
That doesn't... Battery of
doesn't
your mother...
Doesn't check the stars, but...
Battery on the
does keep the clock going.
Okay. But no salt.
No. Just
okay.
Clocks.
Anyway, we're being silly here because you haven't called in. 773-1400. Otherwise, we should tell you something like the headline in Barron's today in the Trader, which is where I go to find out officially what happened in the stock market during the week, is got to be one of the more fascinating headlines. It said U.S. lose 0.7% on week.
U.S. lose 0.7. That sounds like a really bad sportscaster.
It could be us lose 7%, 0.7% on week.
Shouldn't it be we?
Breaking winning streak. It's you period S period lose 0.7% a week, which means that even the reporters and editors, because that's who puts the headlines on these things at Barron's, that venerable institution in New York City, can really screw things up, which also tells you something about why the market declined just a little bit on Thursday. And it is the same reason it tends to decline in the summertime. The big guys went home.
Yeah, everybody went home for it's Easter.
And so they took Thursday off as well as Friday, and as a result, the market kind of sagged down because selling is always acceptable, but buying is a little scary.
What we saw in the market on Friday was...
Friday?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. Nothing happened.
Well, in the U.S. market. Like,
right. In the U.S. market on Friday, we had kind of a non-event, and it was because the market was closed. But it's always fun to report a completely flat day.
I suppose. And the trading volume was?
Zero.
Well, that's really good.
Yeah. But pretty unusual for a Friday.
It is. But there are some trends working out there that I think are also unusual and also relatively pleasant. Let's see. I think it was on, was it Thursday? Yes, Thursday. The Commerce Department, actually with input from the Labor Department, adjusted the fourth quarter GDP. Don't you like that?
Yeah.
Oh, it was Friday. No, they actually...
They came out on Friday
with it. They came out on Friday. That's right. Yeah. Wait a minute. The government was closed on Friday.
Not the people that talk about GDP.
They never sleep. They never go home. I mean, it was officially a governmental holiday on Friday. And apparently the Commerce Department released... I knew I picked this up. Yeah, right there. At 1:25 p.m. Eastern Time, the Commerce Department spoke, which in and of itself. And they said, and for those of you who are waiting with bated breath to find out what the Commerce Department said, first these words from our sponsors. No, we won't do that. What they said is in the fourth quarter, previously they had announced that their best estimates, were that the gross domestic product of the United States grew 1%, which was a lot less than it had grown in the third quarter, 3.6% in the third quarter, and it grew 1%. Now, it really didn't grow 1%. Now, this is one of those things that is understood, so the reporters don't even bother to say it, and I think a lot of them have forgotten it by now. It really didn't grow 1% in the fourth quarter. It grew 0.25% compounded. And so what they do, when you hear the gross GDP reports for a quarter, it's kind of an understood thing, but nobody actually says this except in the fine print somewhere.
Right, and it's never in the headline.
This is an annualized rate. GDP grows 1% in fourth quarter. Wait a minute. That means it would grow 4% during the year.
That's a pretty good growth rate.
And it grew 3.6% in the third quarter, so that's like 4.6%.
Wow, already.
Wow, only not real.
Not real. I'm going to give you let me let you finish what you were you're heading down that road. Go ahead.
Well, now another way of putting this, which you won't see in the news. GDP revised upward 40% for fourth quarter.
Right. Whoa, 40%. Whoa. Well, it's a 40% increase over what we said before.
1% to 4%. But
numbers are funny things.
But the negative side of it is profitability. Now, according to the Commerce Department, overall profitability as a contributor to GDP, overall private firm, company, corporation profitability. Right. As a contributor to GDP, dropped 15%. Whoa!
Wait. But it didn't drop 15%. It dropped 15% from what it was.
No, it didn't even drop 15%.
No.
No, it actually dropped 3.6% from the previous quarter, but it was up actually from the previous fourth quarter. However, for the year, it was up 3.3%, and that all sounds like gobbledygook because it is. I actually went through all of the reported stuff.
Consumer spending was up 4.4%.
Right, and well, I thought it was 3.1, but consumer wages were up 4.4%.
Oh, that's correct, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
This is the interesting thing about all those numbers floating around. You'll notice that when they talk about the percentage of growth and so the gross domestic product of the United States on an annualized, if you annualized out the fourth quarter, it grew 1.4%. But the United States has fundamentally driving its GDP profits. I mean, that's what GDP is, its profits. And they went down, according to the Commerce Department, 15%. It really went down 3.6, by the way. By standard generally accepted accounting principles,
right.
It dropped 3.6% in the quarter if you annualize it.
So if you were just talking about quarterly, it was somewhere less than 1%.
Mm-hmm. But then you go back and look at the previous quarters in the year and you find out there were some big profits earlier on in the year. So the whole thing, again, on an annualized basis,
looked pretty good.
Rises for the year, but not on an annualized basis, rises 3.3%. Now, let me put this in context, if I could. I know I'm
sure.
A monologue here. The price of oil dropped something like 70% during the year of 2015, which seems like a long time ago now. The investment in stuff, which is an economic term, to drill for oil dropped a lot more than that.
Yes.
The production of stuff that is used to drill and transport oil dropped even more than that. And all of the companies out there that transport oil, dig oil out of the ground, refine oil, look at oil, think about oil, loan money to people who have oil or don't have oil, as the case may be, all dropped like a rock. And here's the key. That's for the whole year last year.
Right.
And yet, we had 3.3% growth in profitability, and the year's GDP growth came in at 2.4%. The United States economy, which incidentally is identical to what it did the year before when oil was going up, the United States economy last year grew 2.4%. The largest economy in the world grew, despite the fact that a major element in the economy, now there's two elements, fell off the boat, and the other one literally fell off the boat, is that so much money was rushing to try to get into dollars and into the United States that the dollar over the past couple of years has risen 23% against our trading partners.
That's not a good thing for us. It's a great thing for them.
And we still are growing at 2.4% a year. That is, if you look at it from that perspective, you almost have to say, wow.
You don't almost have to. I mean, some of us had to and some of us didn't. Just depend on whether we actually did it.
I'm not sure that I said wow until now.
You had to do it because you did it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you hadn't done it, you
right,
you
unless I
could
back time up a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
But overall, the story is there, and it's, let's portray this in as confusing and in negative a way as we can, despite the fact, fundamentally, it was tremendously good news. That 4.4% growth in wages is a powerful indicator that through the rest of the year, probably not for the first quarter, which the news will be out on shortly, but for the rest of the year, we will see outsized economic growth and profitability growth in the United States.
We've said this before on the air quite a few times, that any year in the history of the United States in which there is no incumbent running, it's an election year for the presidency, and there's no incumbent or vice president incumbent running for president, that we have lots of volatility in the market, and you have this constant rain of negative news. Hey, I should coin that, constant rain of negative news. So what we're seeing, you've just had a monologue.
I think a consistent cacophony.
Consistent cacophony of negative noise.
Of conflicting.
That's good.
I'll think of another C.
You just want to do
right.
Alliteration.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. And it comes together in that we've had healthy growth in our entire economy for the last several years, while the rest of the world has really been struggling. And yet you don't hear about it. The things that you hear about are the negative things about it. And that's important. Or when you do hear about it, it's just right in the middle of a piece of statistical garbage to most people. Of what does that even mean? We're growing, and we're growing well. Now, that doesn't say anything about the political situation. So don't get me wrong there. Anybody that's listened to us for very long knows that the growth in the economy has very little to do with the sitting president. It has to do with the growth in the economy. And the sitting president is not creating jobs or removing jobs necessarily. They may do it a little bit for government, but even that goes through a pretty massive bureaucracy to get anything done.
But it has nothing to do with the sitting president, but it has a lot to do with those standing for president.
Right. Those standing for president have a lot to do with the economy and how the market moves, for sure.
I think they should all just sit down.
And short-term moments, the sitting president has a lot of control on the economy. If they say something shocking, the market could drop drastically or rise drastically. But long-term, that's not something that they have a lot of control over. Now, I wanted to talk to you about another piece that's kind of similar in many ways in that Business Insider posted this thing, and the headline is, "One Home Builder Executive Perfectly Summarized America's New Housing Crisis." Okay,
I'm waiting.
So that's a scary headline. And basically what he's saying... There's not enough houses out there. This is the CFO of KB Homes. It's the eighth largest home manufacturer, otherwise known as construction firm, in the country. And he's complaining. Now, the essence, the meat of the story here, I totally agree with. The statistics used were the wrong ones. And I'll explain that in a minute. They're talking about first-time home buyers, and some of this stuff is really good stuff. First-time home buyers, only about 50% of the people that have been buying from them for the last 3 years are first-time home buyers. And we're at a pretty historically low point as far as overall home ownership in the United States. We're right at the 61% mark, and we were up close to 70% right before the last crisis. So we went overboard, and now we're way, way underboard. What the executive says here is that first-time home buyers are now paying $100,000 more than they did in 2008 and 2009, and that only 50% of the people buying homes are first-time home buyers. Okay, what do I have as a problem there? Well, first off, that was right in the period with this really, really cool tax credit for first-time home buyers that caused a spike in first-time home buyers like we don't see in the long term. So he's looking at numbers that said first-time home buyers are supposed to be 70 or 80% of the buying population. That's not true. $100,000 per house more. Well, that's because 2009 was the bottom of the housing slump, when all the prices, this is when foreclosures were going rampant, and yes, people spend more money on houses now. The meat of the story is true, though. We don't have enough supply of houses to meet the demand, and there are a lot of millennials that have been saving and plan on getting a house in the next 2 years. And as that happens, and there's not new houses being built, because you have to start building the houses in advance, because it takes a little bit of time to build houses, so that when people come to the market and they say, "I want a house right now," if the house hasn't been built yet, that means that you price it with a lower supply. And that means the prices go up. So there is a bit of a crisis here, and if somebody's ready to get into construction, it might be a good time to do it, because I expect that in the next 5 years or so, we're going to start seeing a pretty good increase in housing prices.
You know, this is when...
It may be temporary.
The key, at least to me, and this is Jeff, as I look at what's going on in the markets now, is that the last couple of years, the overall market growth, and if you've got a portfolio of investments, you probably have seen this too. The last 2 years, you're basically flat, maybe down a little bit. And one of the things that signals a bull market is pessimism. And we've had some really decent pessimism. By the way,
that signals a bull market. Pessimism is a good thing for the market.
And another thing that's important, I think, to notice here is that since February 11th, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is up over 11%. Now, that was just over a month ago. A month and a week, basically, ago. Since then, the S&P 500 has risen 11% in about 5 weeks. That tells you something. The fear is still there that somehow we're going to slip into a recession, somehow things are going to go bad. And as I read and listen to people talk about this, they don't seem to be able to find anything that would cause things to get better. As bad as that sounds, and in my searching, I realized I can't find anything in the news that tells me here is the coming source of better. And when there is lots of bad news, and there certainly is, all you have to do is follow the political scene right now, and there is no good news, pessimism tends to get thicker and thicker and thicker. Here's the reality of this, though. Yeah, earnings were down 3.6% in the fourth quarter, without going back into the definition of what that really means. But earnings were already historically quite high, and the fact that they dropped 3.6% in the face of a collapse in the oil business and a run-up of the dollar, by the way, the dollar has dropped for the past week, which is a good thing. It hasn't dropped as much as I'd like to see it drop, but it's down some. So what we have then is this stream of bad news saying, for instance, the market is so bad. Yes, it's about 6% below its all-time record high. I want you to think about that just a minute. It's about 6% below its all-time record high, and we are unhappy. But there's another element here. Yes, corporate profits were down 3.6%, and I say that over and over again. But here's the key. Americans are saving about, and this is old news at this point, about 5.4% of everything they make. In other words, for every $20 they make, they save a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty astonishingly high for savings rates.
Yeah, for American saving rates, that's incredibly high. That's unusual.
Right. And with our clients, as I talk to them, I find they, by and large, are doing the same thing. Now, why are they doing that? Because they're afraid. Because they think there is a recession coming. Because they think 2008, 2009 is right around the corner. It's going to hit them again. And they are afraid. And that fear is being stoked by the political candidates. So something is about to change.
And I'm going to jump in here and give a historical perspective. This is a change that savings rate is likely to be pretty long term, that we're going to have good savings rates for a long time. And here's the historical context. Because what you just said is that people are saving more because they're afraid of the next recession. And if you're a baby boomer or older, the compromised generation, then listening to this, you're going to understand something. Your parents, and in some cases your older siblings, lived through the Depression. Some of you listening may have lived through the Depression. People that lived through the Depression, their entire saving habits changed. The stories that we hear, the urban legends that aren't so urban legends, they kind of represent a whole generation of people hiding money in the mattress and of people not trusting banks and about people saving a lot more of their money than, you know, or using, as my grandmother did, saving all the napkins that she got at from takeout or from restaurants and squirreling them away. And I think we're all familiar with people that have done that. Well, this is a minor form of that, but it's just as likely to be long-lasting that particularly people that were young at the time of the Great Recession, they felt it the most because they couldn't buy their own home. They couldn't go out and do the things that people just a little bit older than them did. And all their expectations were based on that. And now our clients, as well as people younger than the majority of our clients, are looking at this as saying it might happen again at any moment, just like the people that lived through the Depression did.
The thing is about the Depression, this is going to be different this time. It won't be different next time, what I'm saying is we've been through financial crises before, 2000 through 2002, for example.
Right.
The key here is to get our minds wrapped around a couple of things. Number one, profits are down very slightly, single-digit drop in the fourth quarter, which, of course, is producing, and we're going to see another one probably in the first quarter from the same results. But that isn't the whole story. If revenues go up and the profit levels stay the same or even decline just a little bit, but if revenues go up a bunch and profits stay the same, then the dollar value of the profits will rise substantially in American corporations. As a matter of fact, there's an article in Barron's, a gentleman named Margolis, who has been an extremely accurate manager, very successful manager of mutual funds, and then he went on to manage a very, very, very successful hedge fund for a while, and he's dropped that, and he's doing some other things now as he gets older. He granted an interview to Barron's, which was a pretty rare thing. He expects to see the earnings, the profitability of S&P 500 companies during this calendar year rise by 10%. I want to say that again. He's expecting to see the profitability, the earnings of companies in the Standard Poor's 500 stock index rise by 10%. Now, there's a guy that doesn't have an axe to grind. He doesn't have a dog in the fight, and I could probably cook up two or three more things to say about him.
He doesn't have an axe in the fight or a dog to grind.
You got that.
He doesn't have skin in his...
skin in the game.
He does have
skin in the game because he's got his own money invested. But there is a second issue, and we'll get into that some more later. There's a second issue that also corresponds with that. And again, this is an article that I read. This was actually, I think, in the Wall Street Journal. No, it was in Barron's as well. Mark Hulbert, who's been following the big, massive trends in the markets for many, many years, noted something because it was published in a newsletter. He read it and went back and checked it, and it's true. Whenever the dividend yield of the S&P 500 is greater than the interest yield of the United States 10-year Treasury note. Now, I'm pointedly saying dividends here, not earnings. Dividends, real money that is paid to you each year. If, for example, you owned, which you could almost do this using an S&P 500 index fund, a really inexpensive one, but you would get about 2.23% dividend yield, dividends based on the current value of the Standard & Poor's 500. In other words, if you could buy the entire Standard & Poor's 500 stock index and you didn't have expenses, and I mean, you have to look at this kind of weirdly because if you have enough money, you can basically do that, but if you don't, you can't. If you bought the S&P 500 index at this moment in time, or Thursday, you would receive, and you said, don't reinvest the dividends. I want them in cash. Your money, very likely over the next year, certainly over the last year, is going to earn you 2.23% just flat cash coming in the door. Now, that's going to vary depending on the fund and the expenses in the fund. But I went out and looked at some of the less expensive S&P 500 index funds, and their SEC yield, which is what we're talking about here, is right there. So I'm not suggesting you do that. On the other hand, if you went, let's say you put $10,000 in the S&P 500 index, which, again, is a little weird to do, versus putting $10,000 in 10-year treasury, in a 10-year treasury note. Well, a 10-year treasury note, again, if you bought it on Thursday, by the way, you cannot go back to Thursday and buy either the S&P 500 or the note.
You can't go back in time is what you're saying.
I don't think so. Anyway, 1.9% is what you'd earn on the treasury. Now, what's the difference between those two? It's 12%. What in essence those two numbers are saying is the S&P 500 is 12% undervalued right now. And we got a guy who says, from completely different perspective, comes in and says he expects earnings to rise 10% in the S&P 500, which means if the price-to-earnings ratio stays exactly where it is, there would be a rise of 10%.
People have asked me in the past why it is that we say things like, we give an example and we say, we're not recommending that you actually do this. In this case, the reason why we're saying that is that this is a model that people look at to see if the whole S&P 500 is overpriced or underpriced. And if they're claiming as the whole group of companies in there, that they're going to pay dividends and that it's going to yield about 2.6%. 2.23%. Okay, we compare that and we say in the model, this means that the S&P 500 is underpriced. However, when we say we don't recommend going out and doing it, even though we've just given an example to help it be understood, companies in the S&P 500 fail. Sometimes they don't pay dividends that they say they're going to pay. So it's according to each individual company what actually dividend gets paid, but the expected dividend is used in the model. So that's what I wanted to make sure that was going out there, because there is no guarantee on those dividends. The shareholders or the board can change that in a heartbeat.
And all we're looking at here, again, another little caveat in here, is that we're looking at history. And what we're doing in looking at history is seeing that in all of the history of the S&P 500, which incidentally goes back to 1871, I think, only wasn't 500, but they have a continuous index from 1871 forward. If you take a look at the behavior and you look at the federal borrowing yield on a new treasury note, and you look at the interest rate, the dividend rate offered by the S&P 500 at any given moment in time, the trend for the S&P 500 over the next several years, now this is, again, this is not moment to moment, it's not day to day, this is over years, it's called long-term investing. The S&P 500 winds up higher 10 years hence. Now, you say, of course it winds up higher 10 years hence. Isn't it always rise over a 10-year period? Actually not. No. There are long periods when it didn't. And all you had to do is invest in the S&P 500 in 2000 and note that in 2013 it finally bumped up to pretty much the same level, not counting inflation. And it really didn't make it after we counted inflation until last year. When it peaked last year, if we throw in the even small inflation we had from 2000 through 2015, it barely got to the same level in 2015 that it was at in 2000.
Right. And you can see that same thing happen if you pull inflation out of the picture and look in the 1970s. There was a decade there where the S&P 500 stayed flat, just barely pushed up after the end of the 10-year period.
Well, it actually pushed up after the end of the 10-year period, but if we factor in inflation, it took longer than that.
Right, it took closer to 15 years.
Yeah, one of the things that we really don't think too much about today is the fact that back then, in the late 70s and early 80s, we did indeed have double-digit inflation.
Right, yeah, significant inflation.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here remains, area code 254-773-1400. And we'd love to have you give us a call, but right now we have to keep Town Square Media on the air, and they sell commercial time on the air. That's how they stay in business. And so KTEM and Town Square need us to play some commercials. So we're going to be really, really, really nice to them and do that. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake McClure. And that last commercial, those of you that are listening to podcasts don't know what we're talking about. Those of you that are listening online don't know what we're talking about. But those of you listening in the broadcast radius, that last commercial about safe money is not safe money.
It is a life insurance. It's a scheme to sell life insurance by getting around the state regulations on the selling of life insurance.
Yeah.
And it is probably, maybe, I don't know, technically legal, but it is definitely what securities regulators would refer to as false, misleading, and deceptive.
Yes.
So I do not recommend that you follow the advice of somebody who starts off being false, misleading, and deceptive. Because going down that road leads you into exactly what you started with.
Yes.
So you want to stay away from that. Well, here we are. 773.